Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence, this Tuesday, August 4th, 2026, for our Commodities and Energy edition.
Today, we are examining the breakdown of traditional price stability as geopolitical friction overrides fundamental supply-demand metrics. We are moving away from a period of predictable equilibrium toward a regime defined by strategic bottlenecks and localized volatility.
It is no longer about market efficiency, it is about survivalist logistics.
The implication runs deeper. That tension begins with the renewed pressure on global yields as bond vigilantes react to shifting central bank mandates.
The 30-year Treasury yield just hit a 19-year high of 5.2%, and for those of us watching the energy and commodities markets, that isn't just a number on a screen, it is a massive, expensive signal. Today we are looking at the Fed, the bond market, and the return of the bond vigilantes.
It's a massive signal because the bond market is essentially moving into a regime of active, unprompted policy enforcement. We are seeing a 60 basis point shift from an inverted curve to a positive 40 basis point steepener, which effectively increases the cost of long-term borrowing without the Fed needing to touch the federal funds rate at all.
So the Fed is basically just sitting back and letting the bond market do its own thing. That sounds less like monetary policy and certainly more like a game of let's see who blinks first.
That is exactly what is happening. On Bloomberg Surveillance, analysts noted the death of forward guidance is a deliberate strategic pivot by Kevin Warsh to break the market's addiction to transparency and return to a pre-2008 era where the Fed acts on necessity rather than a predictable telegraph schedule. He is intentionally creating a black box effect.
A black box, right? Because nothing makes commodity traders feel secure about long-term hedging strategies like a central bank president who refuses to provide a roadmap.
It's creating a massive information vacuum. Because Warsh isn't providing a clear reaction function, which is just a fancy way of saying he won't tell us exactly how he will respond to new data, the market is forced to use speculative proxies. We're seeing investors analyzing the physical movements of officials or looking at the behavior of the front end of the curve to guess what the back end will do.
And that guessing is getting expensive. I mean, we're talking about a 118 basis point rise in the 30-year yield since September 2024, even though the Fed has actually been cutting rates by 150 basis points in that same window. That is a complete decoupling of the bond market from the Fed's stated intentions.
It's a structural divergence. The market is essentially hedging against a lack of Fed credibility. If investors believe the Fed's tough talk on inflation is just rhetoric, they will drive long-term yields up themselves to protect their purchasing power. They are essentially trying to snuff out inflation expectations by making it prohibitively expensive to borrow for the long term.
Wait, so you're telling me the bond market is currently acting as a self-appointed inflation cop, bypassing the Fed entirely?
Stepping back, the macro trading floor pointed out that bond vigilantes are currently bypassing inflation swaps to target real growth, pushing up long-end real yields as a medicine to intentionally slow the U.S. growth engine to align with a 2% inflation target. They are essentially performing the Fed's tightening duties for them.
It's like a teenager trying to ground their parents by locking the pantry. But the problem is, if the punishment from the bond market gets too extreme, the Fed might be forced into a corner.
That is the policy mistake trap. We are seeing a reverse operation twist where front-end yields dropped by 6 basis points while 30-year yields surged by 11 basis points. This creates a massive spike in long-term borrowing costs. If this volatility continues to threaten financial stability, the Fed might be forced to implement a sudden, aggressive 50 or 75 basis point hike later this year, not because the underlying CPI data demands it, but simply to suppress the bond market's volatility and restore institutional trust.
Which, for anyone running a capital-intensive energy project or a mining operation, is a nightmare. You can't budget for a maybe when the maybe involves a sudden, massive spike in your long-term debt service.
And it's not just about the interest rates, it's about the lack of a metric. There is significant uncertainty because Warsh hasn't provided an alternative metric to replace the PCE measure. He is moving from a science-based to an art-based policy, which leaves the market guessing whether the Fed is even looking at the same inflation numbers we are.
It's a hall of mirrors, as Richard Clarida described it. The Fed reacts to the bond market reacts to the Fed's reaction, and eventually the whole thing could decouple from actual economic fundamentals like supply, demand, or even actual inflation.
There is also a massive risk of a feedback loop. If these high real yields, which have pushed long-end real yields above 4.5% in some segments, trigger a significant enough growth slowdown, that economic pain could eventually trigger a bond rally. That would be a massive reversal, And since large speculators are at their lowest net short levels in 5 years, the next major move could be a violent short covering rally.
So we are caught between a Fed that won't talk and a bond market that won't stop shouting. It is an incredible amount of volatility for a period that was supposed to be about stabilization.
The structural fragility is real because market participants have spent years decoupling risk management from actual exposure, relying instead on the predictable intervention of central banks. Now that the handholding has been withdrawn, the market is struggling to price the uncertainty.
It's a high-stakes game of chicken. Long-term energy infrastructure investors need to watch the 10-year yield's 4.69% technical resistance level.
If that 10-year resistance breaks, it will likely signal that the market has officially lost faith in the Fed's ability to contain the inflation narrative.
Commodity traders should be bracing for much wider swings in long-term financing costs.
Keep a close eye on the next Fed press conference for any hint of a specific inflation metric or a clearer reaction function, because any return to ambiguity will likely trigger another surge in the long end of the curve.
But as the cost of capital shifts, we also need to look at where the physical movement of goods meets these rising costs. Let's pivot to how tightening bottlenecks are starting to squeeze the global oil supply. If you're a logistics manager for a global construction firm right now, are you even sleeping, or have you just accepted that the Strait of Hormuz is now essentially a toll booth owned by the highest bidder?
It feels less like a toll booth and more like a geopolitical ransom note, Maya. We're looking at a fundamental breakdown in the global energy and shipping supply chains, specifically centered on the massive volatility in crude, diesel, and even asphalt.
It's certainly a choose-your-own-adventure style of catastrophe. One day you're navigating the Red Sea, the next you're wondering if your bitumen shipment is going to arrive in 2027.
And that isn't hyperbole. We are seeing a simultaneous convergence of supply shocks. You have the Houthi maritime threat in the Red Sea effectively having oil volumes, dropping from about 3.5 million barrels per day to just 1.5 million, forcing tankers to divert around the Cape of Good Hope.
Which sounds like a very expensive way to see more of the South African coastline.
It's an astronomical cost. Redirecting around Africa adds 2 to 3 weeks of sailing time. According to Argus Media, the fuel consumption alone for certain voyages can hit $1.5 million per trip, and daily charter rates are already hovering around $9,500 a day.
So we're paying more for the fuel, more for the ship, and waiting longer for the cargo. It's the trifecta of inefficiency.
And it's creating this massive feedback loop. Because the Red Sea is so unstable, Saudi Arabian exporters are trying to pivot. They're moving crude from Yanbu to the Mediterranean via the Sumed pipeline. But the pipeline is a massive bottleneck. It can only handle about 700,000 to 800,000 barrels per day, which is nowhere near enough to absorb the 3 million barrel surge we've seen from Yanbu since this crisis escalated.
And I suppose that's why we're seeing these bizarre, conflicting price signals. One week we're optimistic because of some vague memorandum of understanding, and the next, the market is in a complete panic.
We can trace that further, that mid-June Islamabad MOU provided a brief moment of optimism, acting as a tactical placeholder to stabilize inventories, but that's effectively collapsed. The market has swung from a period of contango back into firm backwardation. And it's not just about the sheer volume of oil, it's about the specific types of vessels available.
You're talking about the clean versus dirty tanker problem.
Yes.
Argus Media notes that the global shipping crisis is transitioning from a crude oil shortage to a looming jet fuel supply crisis. We're seeing at least 15 LR2 clean tankers being diverted from refined product markets to carry high-priced crude. Because these vessels are now laden with crude, you can't just flip them back to carrying jet fuel overnight. The intensive, specialized cleaning required is a massive structural barrier to fixing the supply deficit.
So we're essentially cannibalizing our future jet fuel supply to pay for the immediate necessity of moving crude around Africa. It's almost impressively short-sighted.
It's a cascading failure. And it's not just the Middle East. Look at the Caspian Hormuz Nexus. We're seeing Ukrainian drone strikes on vessels in the Caspian Sea and targeting Russian refinery infrastructure. This has halved Russian diesel exports from 1 million to 500,000 barrels per day. When you combine that with the loss of Middle Eastern feedstock and low Chinese exports, you get this perfect storm in the diesel market.
Which leads us to the much less fluid side of the commodities market. I was looking at some figures earlier. Asphalt prices have risen 14% year-on-year to nearly $500 per ton. That's a lovely, casual way to say road construction just got much more expensive.
It's even more complex in North America. There's a secondary supply squeeze happening. Argus Media points out that the Strait of Hormuz closure is actually incentivizing U.S. refiners to maximize their coking units to chase record-high diesel margins. The problem is that maximizing coking for diesel suppresses the production of heavier residual products, like asphalt. So even though crude availability might be stable, the supply of asphalt is drying up because the refinery economics just don't favor it.
So the refiner makes a killing on diesel, but the person paving the highway is left holding the bag.
The data tells a story that's happening globally. In Brazil, refinery economics act as a persistent barrier to self-sufficiency because the profit from diesel simply outweighs the incentive to produce asphalt.
It's all very interconnected. Even the diplomacy feels like it's just a series of increasingly expensive ultimatums. I mean, Iran essentially rejected the Omani proposal for a joint management system of the strait. Instead, they've issued a counterproposal to control all inbound shipping.
It's a closed or open binary strategy. They are using the strait as a tool of pure brinkmanship. But interestingly, there is an economic logic to their more recent, more localized proposal. Argus Media mentions that Iran's idea for a $1 to $2 per barrel transit fee for the Northern Channel might actually be seen as rational by shippers. When you compare a $2 fee to the $3 to $5 per barrel freight penalty and the month-long delay of going around Africa, the toll starts to look like a bargain.
A bargain in the sense that you're paying a mafia-style state to let you pass, rather than paying a massive premium to the ocean.
It's a grim choice. And the volatility isn't just about the physical flow of oil, it's about how the players perceive the risk. We're seeing a shift in the entire maritime landscape. South Korean owners are staying away from the Bab al-Mandab, while Indian, Pakistani, and Chinese vessels are continuing to navigate it. The Houthi threat has even evolved into a data-driven capability to strike vessels based on their ultimate beneficial ownership, regardless of what flag they fly.
Nowhere is safe if the paperwork says you're connected to the wrong person.
Not if the drones are watching. We're looking at a fragmented, high-risk market where the only certainty is that the cost of movement is trending upward. If we see a simultaneous collapse of the Panama Canal capacity, the Bab al-Mandab, and a major El Niño event, the global energy logistics system could face a systemic failure by the end of 2026.
Ship owners need to stop looking at newbuilds and start hoarding any 5-year-old vessels they can find.
The real signal will be whether the U.S. administration uses the current price fluctuations to shift toward a more negotiated posture, or if we see the next round of retaliatory strikes on Saudi infrastructure.
It's a heavy way to start the week. But if we can survive the collapse of global shipping, perhaps we can figure out how the world is trying to run the next industrial revolution using nothing but silicon and massive amounts of electricity. I was looking at my electricity bill this morning, and I couldn't help but wonder if my toaster is secretly part of a massive global compute cluster.
Given the current trajectory of the AI revolution, you might actually be right. We aren't just talking about more gadgets, we are talking about a fundamental reconfiguration of global commodity flows. The semiconductor industry has effectively become the new oil.
The new oil. It sounds so much more high-tech than a leaky pipeline, but I assume the geopolitical headaches are just as messy.
Something to flag here on the HC Commodities podcast, Chris Miller noted that the U.S. military actually acted as the essential bridge between scientific research and commercial viability by serving as a high-price, high-volume prototype customer. That funding allowed chips to move from lab experiments to the global necessity we see today. But now that supply chain is a massive, concentrated bottleneck. You have the U.S. dominating design software, Japan providing the chemicals, and the Netherlands controlling the specialized lithography tools.
So it's like a global game of Jenga, where if one person in the Netherlands sneezes, the entire digital economy collapses.
It's even more precarious than that. While everyone focuses on the cutting-edge AI chips, the real danger in a Taiwan Strait disruption isn't just losing the next-gen processors. The HC Commodities podcast highlighted that the real threat is the loss of mature technology chips, the legacy stuff used in everything from cars to medical devices, because the industry lacks any redundant capacity to absorb that volume.
It's like being terrified of a sudden shortage of luxury Ferraris, while the real crisis is that all the world's Toyota Corollas just vanished overnight.
That's a perfect way to frame it. And it's not just about the chips themselves, it's about the massive physical footprint required to run them. The AI race is fundamentally an energy race, where the primary constraint on compute isn't just hardware availability, but the ability to scale power supply without triggering decade-long regulatory and environmental delays.
Which brings us to the hyperscalers, the big tech giants. They are spending enough on infrastructure to make a sovereign wealth fund blush.
They are. But Bloomberg Surveillance reported that a fundamental shift in corporate financing is underway. These companies can no longer rely on gobs of free cash flow to fund this massive capital expenditure, which is expected to outpace operating cash flow through 2027 or 2028. We are seeing a transition from high-return monopolies to high-capex competitive businesses.
Instead of just sitting on their mountains of cash, they're essentially turning into massive construction companies, building giant, energy-hungry warehouses.
It's a telling detail. And the smart money is looking for the secondary effects. Capital allocators noted that effective AI infrastructure investing requires looking beyond the obvious data center play to capture higher risk-adjusted returns in the ancillary layers of the stack, specifically in power and fiber. We're even seeing a massive supply-demand imbalance projected for copper, with the IEA forecasting a 25% supply gap by 2035, driven largely by this AI-related capital expenditure.
It's all connected. The chip shortage leads to massive data center builds, which leads to a desperate scramble for copper and electricity. It's a massive high-stakes loop.
And it's getting more complex. Bloomberg Surveillance pointed out that some investors like Ares Capital are already hedging against the AI disruption narrative by focusing specifically on the physical infrastructure requirements, like 150 to 300 megawatt data center deals in markets like Tokyo and London. Even the way companies compete is changing. Amazon's internal silicon strategy, for instance, creates a structural margin advantage over Microsoft because AWS can capture the gross margin that would otherwise go to Nvidia.
It sounds like the margin for error is shrinking for everyone involved.
It certainly is. The winners won't be those with the flashiest models, but those who find the cost per token efficiency through proprietary hardware and stable power.
Investors need to watch the credit markets for any signs of stress in those new off-balance sheet data center-backed bonds. Keep an eye on the next round of US-led export controls on manufacturing equipment, because any new restriction on Dutch or Japanese tools could break the entire dependency loop. But as the infrastructure for this digital era expands, it's also changing how people are looking to park their money in more tangible physical assets.
I've been digging into the recent shifts in private credit, and it feels like the entire plumbing of global finance is being rerouted. We're seeing this massive migration of risk from regulated banks straight into the insurance industry.
So instead of the banks holding the bag, we've just handed it to the people who insure our lives. That sounds like a very efficient way to make sure a bad day in the credit markets becomes a bad day for everyone's retirement.
It's more specific than that, it's a structural flywheel. As Odd Lots pointed out, private equity firms are using their own life insurance subsidiaries to access permanent long-dated capital, which they then use to fund high-yield, illiquid private credit loans through their other subsidiaries. They are essentially capturing the illiquidity premium within a single, vertically integrated ecosystem.
Right, so the parent company provides the loan, the subsidiary provides the cash, and the risk stays conveniently within the family. It's a closed loop of capitalism.
But there's a massive transparency gap. Recent federal investigations into Guggenheim-affiliated insurers, like Delaware Life, revealed that affiliated assets in certain insurers jumped from around 3 to 5% to roughly 40% of total assets under scrutiny.
40%? That's not a diversified portfolio, that's a concentrated bet.
And it's not just about the concentration, it's where the risk is going. Odd Lots noted that systematic risk is migrating from the regulated banking sector into the insurance industry, potentially recreating a 2008-style scenario where regulators rely on opaque third-party private letter ratings that lack any real public track record.
And I assume this isn't just happening in the shadows, it's hitting real, tangible assets too.
There's a signal here, look at the energy and digital infrastructure side. Michael Raffetti at Ares is targeting 150 to 300 megawatt digital infrastructure deals in markets like Tokyo and London. The massive capex demand from hyperscalers is creating a bottleneck where energy and community constraints are likely to slow new capacity. This is driving a shift where infrastructure and real estate are merging into a single category of essential assets, things like fiber and power that are required to keep AI running.
We're trading traditional bank loans for high-stakes bets on power grids and data centers, all funded by insurance premiums.
It's a massive reconfiguration of how we price the physical world.
Institutional investors need to scrutinize the solvency of these PE-backed insurers before the flywheel spins too fast. Just watch for any sudden spikes in shadow reinsurance to Bermuda, because that's where the real exposure might be hiding. But if the foundation of the digital economy is this much energy dependent, how much of this AI revolution is actually just a massive scramble for the next stable power source? So, Alex, are we officially at the point where a single $10 million missile is more expensive than solving the entire global rare earths crisis for the next 2 decades? Because that sounds like a very expensive way to run a budget.
It's not just a figure of speech. According to Odlots, the capital required to fix the rare earths bottleneck is actually negligible when you weigh a $77 million $20-year investment against trillion-dollar AI spends or modern defense budgets. The real issue isn't the price tag, but the structural vulnerability in commodities like tungsten, where China controls roughly 80% of the supply.
Right, so we're essentially playing a high-stakes game of don't let the hegemon turn off the lights, but we're doing it with a massive lack of foresight.
Two things stand out. It's a classic penny-wise, pound-foolish trap. We see the U.S. pushing Project Vault, but there's a massive risk it just becomes a way to hedge common metals like copper rather than securing strategic ones like tungsten or gallium. And the copper problem is even more structural. FICC Focus highlights a looming 25% supply gap by 2035, driven by the fact that new mines have a 15 to 16 year lead time.
So we're building a high-tech, AI-driven future on a supply chain that moves at the speed of a tectonic plate.
And China's strategy is much more patient. On Bloomberg Surveillance, David Fickling and the hosts noted that China uses a chessboard approach, accepting lower financial returns to achieve long-term geopolitical dominance. They can simply flood the market to make Western ventures, like the new Dolphin mine in Tasmania, economically unviable.
It's hard to invite miners to the party when the host can just dump a ton of cheap supplies on the floor to trip everyone up.
That's why we need medium-term price floors at least 3 to 5 years, so miners can actually secure debt.
Commodity traders should start eyeing those Australian and Brazilian deposits as the real volatility plays. Watch for any sudden spike in tungsten price volatility, because if the lack of a futures market prevents new bank financing, the supply crunch will become irreversible. As we wrap up this edition, it is clear that we are witnessing a fundamental rewiring of how value is secured. We aren't just looking at disconnected spikes in diesel or copper. We are seeing the convergence of a breakdown in central bank authority and a physical reconfiguration of global trade. The era of predictable, policy-driven markets is being replaced by a landscape where the cost of moving a barrel of oil through the Red Sea or securing a shipment of tungsten is dictated more by maritime friction and mineral monopolies than by any official mandate from the Fed or the ECB.
So here's the picture. The real takeaway for anyone managing physical assets or energy portfolios is that the margin for error in logistics has evaporated. We are moving from a world of just-in-time efficiency to a world of just-in-case volatility. The single most critical shift is occurring within the capital expenditure strategies of big tech. As these firms scale AI infrastructure, their demand for massive, uninterrupted power and specialized minerals is essentially forcing a massive, unplanned redirection of global energy flows. For an energy trader, this means the tech-driven demand for copper and electricity is no longer a secondary factor. It is now a primary driver of structural supply deficits that will decouple energy pricing from traditional seasonal cycles.
It's a high-stakes scramble where the plumbing of the global economy is being rebuilt in real time.
And the signal that will tell us if this structural shift is accelerating is the 10-year Treasury yield. If we see that yield breach its current resistance levels, it won't just be a market tremor. It will confirm that the bond market has officially stopped listening to central bank guidance and is instead pricing in a permanent high-cost regime for global commodities.
That is the moment the new reality truly takes hold. Thanks for joining us for this weekly digest. We'll see you next Tuesday.